tunnels are underground, where none of the children will ever be found. They wandered away to join the show and lost their way in the world below. They joined the circus and left their town. Now they live here down with the clown.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast covering the adaptation of Stephen King's It, that is Welcome to Derry on HBO. This podcast is split into two sections. In the first section, we call The Calm. We will only cover a single piece of It media. This week, the second episode of Welcome to Derry on HBO, titled The Thing in the Dark, and will not spoil anything we know about future episodes of Welcome to Derry, though we might touch on some adaptation choices that make the book different. In the second Storm section, Neil and I will break down what to expect from It, Welcome to Derry, starting with the next episode that airs on November 9th. We're not spoiling, we're enriching. Why, hello again. I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I've read the book by Stephen King.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I still refuse to read the book by Stephen King because too much clown stuff. And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Some housekeeping before we get started. As Dave mentioned, the next episode of Welcome to Derry is not coming for another 8 days as of this recording, the 9th of November. This one dropped early, dropped on Halloween, so that's why we're in your feeds a little bit early, but we'll be back on Monday the 10th with our podcast for episode 3 titled Now You See It, and of course our Derry era will take us all the way through mid-December, which we're very excited about. You can also watch this podcast on YouTube, youtube.com/@DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil. If you would like to see our smiling faces or the faces we make when we talk about the goopiness of this episode. If you would like more from Dave and I, you can join us on Patreon, patreon.com/DaveandNeil, to get some bonus content from things that you've heard in this feed and a bunch of other podcasts that Dave and I do. We do two other podcasts a week, one the Weekly Adventure Pod. This week was Mailbag Week. Very fun questions we got from all of our wonderful patrons. And we're doing a Hannibal rewatch. We are really in it. We're in the middle of season 2 on our Hannibal rewatch, and it is getting gross. So we're on theme for all of these things. How do you get in touch with this show? You can email us, as always, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Someone did. We're going to read that here in a minute. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The rule, of course, leave us a 5-star rating. Say whatever you want. We didn't get any reviews on Apple Podcasts this week. Again, I'm a little disappointed, but that's okay. I know everybody's busy this time of year. But we did get a comment on Spotify with a correction from a listener named Mustard Doctor, which I think is awesome, who said, minor correction, guys, 1962, not 1964, given it's 27 years for It Chapter 1, which took place in 1989. I don't remember saying 1964, but if we did, that is definitely 2 years off.
It was me.
So there you go.
Thank you so much for your comment. that comment led me to go back and add to the It timeline in The Calm. So
excellent.
I was going to add just like the It timeline in The Calm, just stuff we saw in the show, but we're going to have to include some background stuff. And that includes making sure we're always 27 years apart. So thank you very much, Mustard Doctor.
All right, so I think that's all the business. Time to start The Calm. Where do we want to start, Dave? Do we want to start with this raven, or do we want to start talking about the opening credits?
I would like to start with the opening credits first,
all right,
because they're new here.
Very
notable. And as far as I could tell, are going to apply to the rest of the show because they are showing us some stuff that is, I think, closer to what Mustard Doctor was talking about than what our email is talking about.
Sure.
So we get some visuals that are just tied to It hunting children, but very specifically in this new opening, we get three things that appear to be interesting in terms of what we know about It already from having seen the chapter one and chapter two movies. So we have the Bradley gang, which took place in the 1930s. These are the people with Tommy guns you see being shot up. In the new opening. They're also the people that I suspect are in that car we pull out later in the episode.
Yeah.
But They were also part of a mural in It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2 in that alleyway where they're sort of bandaging up Ben for the first time, where Bev sort of like joins the group. They're doing it against this mural about this Bradley gang massacre, where back in the day, the people of Derry sort of rose up and mass executed a gang of, gangsters, just general gangsters, 1930s gangsters.
The local mob.
But it was based on a real incident that happened in Bangor, Maine, where the people sort of like rose up and shot a whole bunch of criminals. And when, you know, eventually it was being investigated, everyone's like, yeah, I don't know who did it, but obviously the whole town had been out. Mm-hmm. So it looks like we might be dealing with that. That is definitely in the opening.
Sure.
And then the Ironworks explosion. Well,
these credits also suggest that there was a clown there.
Yes.
hanging off of a building.
Yes. To be fair, that is pretty book accurate in terms of the Bradley gang in It, the book, is that some people see a clown there.
Cool.
Some people see some other things there. We'll maybe get to it as the show gets to it. And then the Kitchener Ironworks explosion. This one happened on Easter, which is why you see a flaming rabbit in the opening. But it was covered in the first movie, where just a whole bunch of kids were on an Easter egg hunt and the ironworks exploded. That is what started our cycle, one of the previous It cycles in 1908. So we're seeing two of the previous cycles in this, and then also some generic imagery that looks like it could read now. And now being 1962, as we were reminded. And then obviously there's the duck and cover classroom, where we have the Niebolt Street house, and we pull out and it's in front of a mushroom cloud, and we pull out further and that is all on a projector that a teacher is using to educate. And we pull back and we see a glove on the projector that is maybe Pennywise glove. Mm-hmm. But that is the most that we've seen so far of Pennywise in the 1960s. Otherwise, It is still, or Welcome to Derry is still having It manifest as other people's fears.
Sure.
What do you think of the new intro, Neil?
I like it. I actually like, there's several like structural things that this episode does that I think seem like things that they will continue to do going forward in this season that I kind of dig. And one of them is what happens before this intro, which is like, it's like a half cold open, half previously on, like, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but this opening scene where we go back to the movie theater the night that the kids are killed, some of that is from a different angle, right?
Yeah, it's all from Lily's perspective.
Yeah.
Whereas some the of that is stuff sort of we haven't seen.
So it's kind of like a, instead of a previously on, it's like, let's go back to the key scene from the previous episode, but we're going to show it to you in a slightly different way. So I kind of hope they keep doing that. That's fun. And then, yeah, I immediately started clocking various events in this intro where I was like, ooh, this feels like the things that they're going to be flashing back to. And I think a lot of that's going to have to do with, you mentioned them pulling the car out at the end, as the military is finding artifacts that they're digging up. I have a feeling these artifacts are going to turn into flashbacks real quick.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because it'd be fun to get some details on that. And then we see the entire sequence, and it's set to A Smile on a Ribbon by Patience and Prudence, a song from the late 50s, where all the creepy songs soon become horror movie soundtracks. That's just the era that you and I grew up, Neil, is at some point where like 1950s nostalgia played over the right thing. Very, very creepy.
Yep.
And here we have it once again with It. We did, as you mentioned, get a email this week. Would you like to read Ross's email excerpt here, Neil?
Yeah, and this comes from, this is an excerpt, yes, as you mentioned, from Ross, who wrote us a slightly longer email with observations, but I thought this one was maybe the most relevant. Ross says, during your discussions and my own reflections post-Mutant Baby, I decided that setting this series during the Cold War is pretty clever. The Cold War thrived and existed on fear, the titular character's bread and butter. Fear of nuclear Armageddon, fear of the communists, and just fear of anything that existed in opposition to the white paradise of Ozzie and Harriet sitcom land. Throw in the growing push of the civil rights movement and racist American backlash to a world of equality, and well, it may be kind of hard to pinpoint a time prior to the 1980s when people were as scared. I think this is a really good point and potentially a strength for the show. I mean, we kind of made fun of it. We laughed at it last week when, guess the week before when we were talking about the previews and the reviews where reviewers were starting to talk about how the military wanted to use Pennywise in the cold to win the Cold War. And it's a little bit less silly now that I see it in the context of the episode, I guess, but it does make sense, right? Like, and I think further emphasizes the themes that this entire story is kind of working with, which is like, it goes back to a time where, just like the music, it was meant to look aesthetically. It is a time where things were, you know, peaceful and prosperous and progressing in American society. And one would say like good, right? It's funny because like when Donald Trump was initially running for president, his Make America Great Again, when he was like, I want to take America back to when it was great. A lot of people thought he was talking about like this time period, right? The 50s and the 60s, which is funny because they had free healthcare back then. Anyway, but as Ross points out, it is true that this was a time of intense societal fear of all of these external forces and specifically the nuclear bomb. So I think that that definitely works here. And then
like that you pointed out the difference between the aesthetic of it and the feeling of it, because I think that's what spotlights the early 60s very specifically. Because the 70s, lots of parts of America were terrified for lots of different reasons. And so
and you could see more terrified.
Fear manifesting. Yeah, and there are parts of the Cold War that obviously get more terrifying as we're moving towards, you know, Bay of Pigs and everything right now in the show. But I do think it's very smart to, especially in a town like Derry, and a lot of stuff that this episode sort of brings to the series, is not only is there a lot of fear, but everybody's pretending there isn't any fear. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like, everything's mostly fine. We have it under control. You know, we beat back the last world war, you know, we'll figure out Korea eventually. But like America's still in power here. But there is this latent fear in the background that they're not necessarily portraying. And I think this week we get to take a step outside of watching a bunch of kids die and see how this town has been infected by it overall. And we get to do that, you know, by the introduction of more of the Hanlon family and sort of the building of this new group of losers, but also through some more generic things that were happening everywhere, not just in Derry in the early 1960s, which is sort of how I read Hank Grogan, the projectionist, getting framed for the disappearance of some white kids, as we see at the insistence of like a councilman and some high up townspeople sort of bullying the sheriff into making sure some charges drop down. I am so far very impressed with this show and very confused about those reviews you referenced earlier that seemed to be like this show could be bad, because like this episode is run, it's over an hour runtime with credits, but they've now had basically a full film's worth of runtime, and I think they kept it pretty focused and pretty character based, and I'm getting a very good idea of what world that I'm living in and what the goals of this series are. I can only assume that maybe in the coming episodes things go off the rails. But what I was really worried for in this episode was, if you're going to deal with race, you gotta not be super ham-handed with it. Otherwise, you might as well have not dealt with it at all. And these aren't necessarily black filmmakers, but they do have, they have decided to tell this story and make this a part of it. Did it work for you, bringing in the Hanlons the way that they did?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does, because there is quite a bit of nuance to it, it feels like, right? And it also feels like it is sort of creating this picture of what it was like to be in that time period, you know, in a city that thought of itself as woke, right? Like being in the North, right? This is something,
right?
I don't know. I feel like this is something I notice a little bit more, being someone who grew up in the North of the United States and then lived the other half of his life in the South. Just the way that the people that live in these places carry themselves. And I would imagine during the civil rights movement in the early 1960s, that was even more magnified. So I think it's interesting, like, cause you know, I think the sequences with Charlotte going around town are really interesting to me. You know, her, mm-hmm. her interaction with the butcher guy, who's weird, but some, you know, mostly charming, I guess. But then,
yeah,
you know, her trying to break up the fight with the kids, where it's like, I would say that reads as like 60% those kids are just little racists, but also 40% there's like something seriously, seriously wrong with all of the people of this town. And it's like more of a supernatural thing, than anything else. So I think that's interesting. And I just honestly think there's just a little bit more nuance to it. There was one name that I spotted in the credits that I think might be helping the Muschietti's out here, which is consulting producer Cord Jefferson, who worked with Damon Lindelof on Watchmen, mm-hmm. who I think is, and also worked on Station 11. And I think might have something to do with why this storyline feels a little bit more nuanced and interesting than ham-fisted.
Yeah, I'm glad they're doing it, and I think it could be really interesting questioning where is the border between something like it influences and just people.
Yeah,
like maybe I've
just the racism
watched
of the time.
Frankenstein. Yeah, maybe I've watched Frankenstein too recently, but maybe the humans are the monsters. Oh no, wait, that was Alien Earth. That I definitely watched that recently. But like, if that, I do agree that's going to be part of it, and that kind of has to be part of it, especially with a character like Staff Sergeant Masters, who's just like really blatantly racist, and whose point in the story is to be the really racist one. He's not throwing down era accurate slurs, mm-hmm. which I appreciate. I appreciate that sort of balance to it. But I am wondering where we're going in terms of Charlotte, very specifically being a former activist in Shreveport. Mm-hmm. And it seems like now Leroy is hoping that she's going to settle down a little bit in Derry. Like you were saying with that North and South divide, like maybe if it's in the North, you won't agitate as much.
Sure.
As you would have down in Shreveport. But and I'm interested to see where that goes.
I don't think she can help herself. I think that's the point of that scene with the kids, where it's like,
oh yeah,
as the butcher is like, well, you know, that's just kids being kids. Got to just let them do their thing, which is the vibe of the rest of the town. She can't let it go.
And I think it's important to remember that it just mostly hunts kids because those are the things that it is easiest to make a meal of. But it can hunt adults. So I'm interested to see what happens to somebody that has those strong views going into Derry. Is it a situation where she's going to become part of an antagonistic force to whatever it's trying to do? Or does it get its creepy little claws into her, and by the end of the season, she's also not paying attention to nerds getting beaten up in the streets of Derry?
Mm-hmm.
Could go either way. How much can it pollute a person? I think will be interesting to track with
sure.
all of the Hallorans.
She does,
or the Hanlons.
I will say this, by establishing her character as someone who was like politically involved, she does seem like the kind of person who might want to get involved with the case of a wrongfully accused man.
Ooh, yeah. I could see that happening. That, of course, is speaking about good old Hank Grogan. We learn a little bit more about Ronnie here. Let's do some loser tracking as we lost three in our first episode. It now seems a little bit dangerous to be a loser, but it does look like we're at least grouping around some new kids. So Ronnie and Lily survived. Ronnie, we learn, lives not only with her father, who we suspected, but with her grandmother, who has some opinions about how to educate Ronnie. And there's, I think, a very interesting conversation about how much she needs to be brave and keep her head up in the face of society versus how much Hank is willing to sacrifice that in order to keep her safe. Which might have backfired on him at the end in terms of like being cloistered off, because it does seem like when Ronnie does return to school, people are like, oh, what is she doing back here? So she's obviously going to face a bit more adversity integrating with the group. Did we see her in school in the first episode? I don't think we did.
No, I think we just saw her at the movie theater.
Yeah.
But I mean, the kids treat her like she's been at school, you know, like they know her.
Yeah, they know. But I'm wondering if like he's been keeping her out of school since January, you know, since the first kid disappeared, because she was a material witness in that. Or has he just been keeping her out of school since last week's events?
Yeah.
Where, you know, she came back all like bloody and now doesn't.
I actually had a little trouble tracking the timeline. It seems like it maybe has been more than just a week since the movie theater thing. Because the principal at one point does the announcement where he's like, thank you for coming to last week's vigil, which that would have been a couple of days after. So like this might be like 2 weeks.
After it might the be movie theater. Even longer than that, because how long do you have how long before you assume the kids are just dead, which everybody seems to be assuming now, which is sort of something that was changed in It Part One with Georgie, who in the book very obviously dies, but in the movie is his being missing is sort of what gets Stutter and Bill to go down in the sewers. And then we have Ronnie has another encounter with it. In her room. And I think this is where I have a lot of questions about this. First of all, it seems like Ronnie's fear, at least at this point, is that she had killed her mother in childbirth.
Yeah.
That seems to be because we see a picture of her mom before her mom manifests as it. And so she's obviously not there. And my you ripped out of me, whatever the haunting says to her, seems to imply that that's her fear.
Yeah. And it creates an interesting parallel with her and Lily, right? They both have trauma where they feel responsible for the death of one of their parents.
Right. I have a question in terms of like this particular monster. Do you think this show is trying to say something about giving birth?
I don't know.
Yeah, we've had two basically birth trauma thing, like really birth trauma scares in two episodes.
Gnarly birth sequences. This one goopier than the last. 2 weeks in a row. So, you know, I feel like the show wants to say something. I'm not sure what they're saying just yet, but I can't tell if this is just a way to connect Ronnie and Lily in a way that will, right? Because this episode sees them obviously have a very contentious moment, right?
Right.
And sort of pushes them apart, but we kind of have the feeling that they're going to need to come back together in order to solve the situation or fight against the clown. So the one bond that they share is that they both have this belief that they killed one of their parents. So I just... Yeah, I mean, I think that this one very effective in delivering what Ronnie is ultimately traumatized about, which is the death of her mother. And crazy. That's got to be mostly practical effects.
I mean, right? There's a lot of practical effects that are then augmented digitally, I think.
Yeah. But like they had like to like build that bed piece with like the mother's head.
I think I had to build the bed piece with the actress, you know, like half in it, playing the mom, sort of like leaning over doing stuff. I think all the mom turning into like the burning face, that's all digital augmentation. Sure.
It's probably mostly digital when she stands up.
Yeah, and I think the mouth is entirely digital. The mouth in the uterus, the uterus mouth.
Sure, with the deadlights.
with the deadlight eyes inside. Letting us know just in case we thought it was something besides it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that is interesting because we do sort of see the eyes. The eyes are very noticeable in the book as letting you know when something is a manifestation of it. And mm-hmm. that is something the movies kind of abandon. So it would be interesting to see if the eyes start to become something here.
Is it?
I would be into it.
Is it notable that here there are only two of them, whereas in the movie there are three deadlights?
Well, here there are definitely eyes.
Yeah.
In the movie, when we see them and they're three, they're like the deadlights. That's like the entirety of its mm-hmm. being or whatever. So I think these are deadlight through the eyes, not necessarily the deadlights.
Got it.
Because usually when people see the deadlights, like that's it. They, you know, you remember what happened to Bill Hader.
Mm-hmm.
Just instantly, these are eyes. So that is like the presence of the evil. That's like some sort of sign to us that it is in there.
Sure.
But like when Mrs. Kirsch terrorizes Bev in It Part Chapter 2, her eyes are never yellow. So, but in the book, every time there are times where something horrible happens and the kid looks up and it's a thing with yellow eyes. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to see if we're going to start using it yellow as a way of denoting who's being taken over. There's something like that happens at one point in this episode with Marge, which I guess we could do as a way of talking about Rich and Will,
mm-hmm.
who are two new additions to the Losers. Will moves to the dairy with his family. My main thing I got from him is seems like a nice guy. He likes science.
Yeah. He's not sportsy. Is there any other, like,
he's
a soft boy. He's a sensitive, intelligent boy, I think. That's what I'm going with. Well, because it's like, you see this in the way that his dad speaks about him, where he doesn't seem to understand him, right? So you have this,
yes,
you know, rugged military guy who does seem like a sports guy who doesn't understand his son because his son doesn't really like any of the traditional things. And really the truth is just that like his son's a nerd. So,
right.
And he doesn't know what to do about that. I am curious though, now that we know that for sure that, the dad has this thing where he has no fear. I guess that mm-hmm. was caused by his injury, but I wonder if any of that, you know, is genetic.
Oh, so that Will's going to have some sort of power that then passes on to Mike that then helps it eventually be defeated someday.
Yeah. Or maybe even by genetic or by nurture, by just being around his dad, maybe Will has a different relationship with fear than the other kids.
I mean, things don't turn out good for him and his wife. They definitely burn to death in a house before
sure.
it chapter one starts.
Sure. But like as a kid, so, maybe he has, you know, some wins.
It will be interesting to see what he's bringing to the Losers Club when the new Losers Club reunites. The other one is Rich, who mm-hmm. seems to be taking some pity on Will, both complimenting his pencil and then later seen eating an empanada in the hallway with mm-hmm. a Cuban baseball player hanging up in his locker, just to make sure we know he's the Latin one.
I will say this, that empanada is the best looking, most delicious looking food in the entire show. All the other food looks
yes.
gross, but that empanada looked really good.
I'm not super psyched with, like, yes, the Hanlon cooking. That's not great. But also in a world where the Jewish family eats matzo ball soup and challah bread, him just eating an empanada by himself at his locker. I'm like, all right, guys, like ethnic people eat their food, like just eat normal food like everybody else. That being said, yes, great looking yellow empanada. He seems to have some sort of crush on Marge. And when Marge walks by, there's a moment that some people have been talking about on Reddit where the like sun sort of hits her glasses mm-hmm. and makes her eyes glow a little bit yellow. And she does a smile that really forces her two front teeth as being forward, which in some places would be an indication that she is being like used by it. But Marge throughout the rest of the episode just seems to be a conflicted little girl. Mm-hmm. What did you make of what happened to and with Marge this episode?
I mean, I also noticed that, and it is kind of weird because she's obviously not currently under the influence of the clown, as far as we can tell, but maybe that is a little bit of foreshadowing as to, you know, what Marge's role here, because she doesn't seem to be like she's going to be one of the losers necessarily. She seems kind of just outside the circle. And I don't know. I actually kind of find that kind of confusing. I couldn't tell if Rich was like in love with Marge or one of the patty cakes. And then the Marge eyes thing kind of threw me off because I was like, is this also like foreshadowing that she's going to be involved? And then one thing that I couldn't get out of my mind about Marge is we talked about this in the, you know, the Weeks Ahead trailer that we watched last week, is like at one point in that trailer, she shows up with an eye patch on right. her right eye. And I wonder if that has something to do with it. I also, in the scene where they actually do the patty cakes, was fully convinced that someone was going to hit her in the face accidentally.
Ah, yes.
Like she was going to get distracted and look to the side and someone was going to whack her right in the eye.
When the patty cakes first started happening, the first time I watched it, I was like, this is a weird, like, this feels like a made for TV or like a movie thing where it's like, we got to call this gang something. We're like, we're mm-hmm. going to call them the patty cakes. Why? Well, like, because they do this thing, but like, it didn't naturally come out of like anything that kids would do. That's what I thought initially. Mm-hmm. Then I remembered, Neil, that when I was in seventh grade, we used to have a club called the Toe. And basically, you would paint your right big toe a certain color denoting your rank within the club.
Oh, okay.
And we would both need like nail polish and use the paper whiteout combined with like some ink. So you would write out your toe and sort of like scratch your rank into it. And I was like, that's pretty weird. Maybe the patty cakes aren't as weird sure. as I thought. Maybe that is something dumb
also,
kids do.
They didn't have the internet. They barely had TV. The patty cake was one of the more exciting things they had back in the day.
Yeah, makes more sense than 6-7, as I've been reminded recently. But yeah, I am interested to see what happens to her. I think because she gets shut down, like they make a really good point this episode of two times Marge gets like a little too funny mm-hmm. and the lead mean girl sort of bats her back down. So I know we get an eye patch, but I think it's 50-50 at this point on whether that eye patch is supernatural or not.
Sure.
That lead girl could just take a
yeah.
Stephen King bully turn and go right after
her. I am definitely leaning toward it being another child doing that to her.
Because I do think she might be part of the loser, right? I'm only including her in the losers more by age group category. Mm-hmm. Because right now, none of the losers are really together. I guess Will and Rich are the most friendly to each other.
Sure.
But we haven't really figured out, I don't think really what either of their fears are. So mm-hmm. they're more safe than the other girls.
Yeah.
Do you think Marge's actual fear is just like, you know, social, being ostracized socially?
Yeah, I think so. That seems to be it so far. Or it's some sort of eye trauma. She definitely was afraid of her eyes being looking bug-eyed with her glasses. But that is true. That is more about like social ostracization and
being an outcast.
Yeah.
And then we have Lily, who has a tough episode this week. We were talking about in the storm, maybe we would have opened with Lily already having gone back to Juniper Hill, because that stuff's crazy that she saw with a two-headed mutant baby kill all of her friends. But it turns out she just told people she was there and she didn't necessarily see what happened, but everybody was covered in blood. And I'm going to assume, based on last week's episode's ending, they at least had little Susie's arm that Lily was left holding at the end of the episode. Mm-hmm. So things look bad, and she is afraid to say, "Hey, I saw a mutant baby fly out of the screen," because they would send her back to Juniper Hill. But in doing so, sells out Ronnie's family, essentially. And
almost gets the murder pinned on herself.
Yes, I think that's mostly the chief strong-arming the kid,
which is,
but I do see where that fear comes
some
from.
Some real ACAB behavior from the chief. Manipulating a child like that is bad stuff. To accomplish. And what's interesting is that the episode goes out of its way to show us that the chief knows better, right? That the chief is
right.
He clearly knows they don't have the evidence to arrest Ronnie's dad, and he is being pressured by the town to do something. So he manipulates this little girl into not even necessarily like pinning it on him, just vaguely saying that she can't be entirely sure that he wasn't there, and that's enough. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. So, and then sticking her in fucking Juniper Hill anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think her mom does that after she is attacked by it in the supermarket. This is just a great sequence. Mm-hmm. I see why they showed this to some people at conventions before the show aired, because if you showed me this sequence, I'd be like, yes, it is back. It has nothing to do with the books that I can tell. Mm-hmm. It really shows how it can manifest like these psychic things specifically to children. Nobody else sees what Lily sees in the shopping mall. And it shows how it's able to almost like psychically feed off of you in a very specific way. So she starts hearing people talking about how she's crazy behind her back, and then slowly turns the shopping mall into sort of like a maze that sort of like cuts her off with, I think, the scariest things in the episode, which are random background actors smiling and getting incredibly close to her while walking in weird ways in the background that only we can see.
Yeah, like the guy just like bobbing and weaving behind her. That's so creepy.
Yeah. And all of that, I'm just like, this is great. This is stagecraft. This is cinematography. But it is an Andy Muschietti directed episode, so eventually all the pickles turn out to have pieces of her dad in her, a very tentacly version of her dad that has fewer torso parts but lots of tentacle parts, who sort of reconstitutes himself and demands a kiss. But again, I don't mind it, knowing that's how these sequences are going to climax, because that's the adaptation of it we're watching.
Sure.
I still think it was kind of effective as like a goopy digital effect.
Yeah. I mean, I will say this, the part where it reveals the dad's head inside the pickle jar, like the part where the body parts are like in the pickle jars, is so good and well executed that I'm willing to forgive how like kind of sloppy and goopy it is when they hit the floor and it turns into this little like goop squid monster. Because I was like, all right, that's a little much. But the part where it like turns into her dad's face in the pickle jar is like really cool. And I'm like, okay, this is fun. We're having fun now.
Yeah.
Like this is I think, you know, we talked about this when we talked about the movies and how, you know, some of the ways that Pennywise terrified the kids worked and some of them didn't. And a lot of them just sort of eventually pivoted to the clown being there. I think these, the two that we see in this episode, are far more effective because the clown's not there. And because of how embedded they are in the specific fears and traumas that these kids have. Right. Like this is a joke. It's not a joke. It's like this is a visual gag that the show has been setting up since the beginning of the first episode, that it pays off at the kind of the very end of the second episode.
Yeah, I think it's really a Nightmare on Elm Street franchise where it's just like you're tailoring the horror sequences to a specific character, which I think is great. I am hoping that when we get to Pennywise, they've made it feel like Pennywise is the natural extension. Like when we get to clown, it's like, well, of course it would be a clown in this situation. But we'll have to see going forward.
What this makes me interested for is to see what it's going to look like when it terrorizes an adult. Like, yes. I think about Dick Halloran and I'm like, what if it wants to go after Dick Halloran? What would it use to terrify that guy, right? Or what would it use to terrify Charlotte or, you know, any of these other adult characters that we've met? So I imagine that there could be like a fun escalation when it goes to terrify an adult, as opposed to, because, you know, kids are easy to scare. Adults, a little more complex. So we'll see.
We're having so much fun with the kids. I do like to see, I am looking forward to see what that sort of escalation is. And maybe this is a great way to transition to our It's a Cold, 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 Cold War segment. Because you're right. We got Dick Halloran finally name dropped. He has some special privileges on this base. It turns out they are using his shine to track some objects, and right as Major Fuller is saying maybe they're investing a little bit too much in him, they pull the Bradley car out, which I think is all pretty cool. I am a little wondering what Dick's headspace is at this point. But I do like this as like an introduction. I like him drinking with the other black airmen at the bar. I like when they get kicked out. Somebody's like, is there nowhere we can drink around here? Which sort of sets up that eventually we will have to deal with the black spot or create the black spot, a club for the black airmen, which doesn't end well. But that does mean that I think they're going to do it with the black airmen and not, as I had previously guessed, maybe with the kids. So I'm liking where all this is going. And you are right that like he's high on my list of people to try to see scared. I do think he could be easily scared. It'll be interesting to see how much they want to play into the fact that Dick Halloran shows up in The Shining. Because if we learn more about Dick Halloran in The Shining and his sort of like background, and he had a abusive elder man in his lifestyle, a sexually abusive elder man in his lifestyle who was also kind of a sadist. And is that the sort of thing that would scare him, or would like some stuff that happened to his family in the past sort of scare him? Or is it out of time and it sees Dick Halloran as being like someone that eventually has to be in The Shining? Are we going to get like a future? Is he going to find himself in the snow in the mountains in some sort of vision or something?
Could be interesting.
So it's going to be interesting to see when that happens.
I suppose the other option for it terrifying an adult is if it has to make multiple attempts to scare Leroy. Right? Because the Pennywise or it doesn't know that he can't fear, that he doesn't have fear. So it's probably going to try it a couple of times. And I keep thinking back to like the Weeks Ahead trailer where there's like those shots of like Charlotte looking like she might be like drowning or like it's kind of
shot in the head,
zombified or shot in the head. I think that could be part of it trying to scare Major Hanlon and it not working, because obviously he has no fear.
Yes. That is the great thing. And the thing that you're like, I can't wait to see it attack adults. I can't wait for the military to be like, we're going to roll over this thing. This it's like, it's a clown.
Obviously we'll be able to control this entity and use it against the communists.
Can't wait to see how wrong they are and how very specifically how it convinces them they're wrong through their own fears. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we mentioned sort of being weary because of the early reviews. On paper, it sounds ridiculous, right? That the military is searching for the it in order to use it. But again, in execution, in context, it makes complete sense. It's exactly the kind of thing the American military would try to do. And it is walking a chunk of characters on this show into a situation where they may literally be scared to death on the spot. And that could be fun to watch, I think.
I think
it's much more fun watching the adults get it than the kids, I will say.
Yes. I think it hasn't played as dumb yet, because it's very obvious from what General Shaw says in this episode. They don't know what it is.
Yeah.
They know it manufactures fear, and it seems to be here because of these artifacts. Mm-hmm. But they're going to find it through finding the artifacts and then hopefully weaponize it.
Yeah. In a world where they believe in a certain amount of like magical realism, right? Because they believe that to a certain extent that Dick Halloran has some sort of ability, right?
Yes.
So like the military is on board with this being some sort of unexplainable phenomenon that is beyond what the science of the time can understand.
We are in the height of the military believing this. This is like MK Ultra Manchurian Candidate fears. This is that era.
And it'll be interesting to see how the show sort of closes the door on that, right? Because in 1989, the military is not involved at all.
That's what I'm worried about, is that, maybe worried about, is there's a weapon that causes fear. There's a fear bomb underneath Derry and we need to find it. Mm-hmm. Is something the military do. There's a clown that eats children underneath the city and we would like to release it in Cuba is dumb. Mm-hmm. So they need to sort of bridge that gap very carefully in terms of what the military's understanding of what it is.
Sure.
Because we know it's a super cosmic force and there's no way they're going to be able to control it.
Yeah.
But they think it's like a Roswell, New Mexico thing, you know, like it's an artifact.
Well, and I think my theory here is that the way this ends for the military is so horribly that the larger military is like, we're going to pack this away and forget about it forever. Mm-hmm. Like, we're never coming back to this. Like, to the point where it's almost like they don't remember it or they're not aware of it. Like, this is so top secret that if all of these dudes on this base get wiped out, no one else in the American military is even going to know that it happened, which is why no one ever comes back looking for Pennywise again.
Definitely. There's two options to get out of this series, Neil. It gets you, or you leave Derry and the amnesia gets you.
Sure. Which I assume is what happens to Dick Halloran. He leaves Derry and forgets about it.
He could see something there. He's just like, I'm not going back. Like,
that's true.
Dick Halloran doesn't want to face the Overlook Hotel either. Like, he just happens to be shining somewhere that, you know, the kid shows up. So he's not necessarily a hero. He just has this ability. He could become a hero, and it would be interesting if that's what this narrative is sort of like leading us to. Because he does seem a little bit distant now, but I could guess, knowing what little bit I do about the powers of The Shining, that he just seems distant because he's like reading everybody's true intentions. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be a weird way to live as a black serviceman in Derry. We talked a little bit about Leroy. He definitely figured out what was happening with that fake assault. Played a pretty good scene with Masters and getting him to not be able to load a Soviet gun.
Great scene.
And I think is going to be all in on this. But I am interested that at least when the episode ends, I don't think he's fully convinced. I think he's convinced they think there's something out there. But he, it seems like not having fear has also made him very logical. Mm-hmm. And maybe the fear also took some other type of emotion with it. I am no brain scientist. I don't know that much about the amygdala. But I have seen Hovind Adepo act in other things before, so I can read that some of this is slightly more stilted.
Sure. Well, we've seen him be a true believer in The Leftovers.
Exactly.
Well, and I think, you know, that's also sort of part of the nature of fear, right? When I think about, you know, when you become deeply afraid of things, you're not only afraid of like the real part of it, but you're afraid of the parts of the situation that your brain adds on to it. Right. You know, like Ronnie's fear, for example, is that she killed her mother in childbirth. And the way that fear manifests is far more horrible than it would have actually played out in real life with her mother dying in childbirth. Right. Or like, you know, if you're in a dark basement alone, your mind is making up, like the fear is driving your mind to make up what could be in the dark. So if he doesn't have that, his brain isn't making up any of that extra stuff. So he's only really dealing with like the cold, hard reality of the situation. So I agree. I think he's maybe not sold yet, but I imagine spending more time with Dick Halloran is going to push him closer and closer to believing that something's going on here. Or he's going to spend more time with his kid and his kid's going to get involved with it and he's going to realize that that's part of it. Or the clown's going to attack him. That'll make a believer out of you real quick.
Deal with it.
He won't be scared of it, but he'll believe it.
Yeah. And also, like, there's differing definitions on if the clown feeds on fear or if, like in the book, it just likes fear because fear makes the meat more tasty, but it feeds on meat. So like Leroy Hanlon not being afraid is like a defense to a certain extent, but we don't know. Is it just like, is it the rules of It Chapter 2? It must abide by the laws of whatever form it inhabits. And that's how Leroy could maybe beat it because it limits its forms.
Right.
Or if it's like, you're not afraid of me, and then just turns into a giant mouth and swallows him. It's like, it doesn't need him to be afraid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the rule at the end of the first It movie is that once the kids decide that they're no longer afraid of it is when they're able to defeat it.
Right.
So,
because they make it feel small.
But that is the kids at first being fearful and then deciding that they're no longer fearful. He's going into it without the ability to even have that fear. So I almost feel like there could be a slightly different sort of reaction, chemical reaction between him and it.
Yeah. It might be closer to like Adrian Mellon, the poor guy that gets killed at the beginning of It Chapter 2, where it's like most of the damage is done to him before it even shows up. Mm-hmm. And then when it just shows up to take a chunk out of his chest and finish the job. But we'll have to see what happens when Leroy Hanlon shows up. One more character I want to talk about. We get, well, kind of two more characters sneakily. Mm-hmm. We get our first peek at Rose, the owner of Secondhand Rose, the indigenous woman who looks like she knows more than she's leading on. I am excited she's here
mm-hmm.
because what a angle to finally talk about from the It story is the Indigenous people's angle, and hopefully better than what happened in chapter two, where they were mostly reduced to goo monsters. We already have a whole couple of Indigenous cast members, so we're on our way.
Sure.
And then second, I really like the very specific call out to a young shopkeeper that will eventually be Stephen King in It Chapter 2 is hanging out in the shop secondhand rows that he will eventually keep. I like that little bit of continuity,
yeah,
specifically to the Muschietti versions. That's also like a small Stephen King cameo in a way.
Yeah, I like it. And I'm also a big fan of this actress, Kimberly Norris Guerrero, who has been in, she was in Reservation Dogs. She was on Rutherford Falls, which is another one of my favorite mm-hmm. Indigenous led shows that was sadly canceled before its time. She's really great. So I hope that she's got a lot to do here. She doesn't, you know, quite have a whole lot to do in this episode, but you know,
no.
This seems like she's forging a relationship with Charlotte that I hope will be useful as we go forward.
I would like those two to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. I would like Rose to talk to the kids, but if that's not going to happen, I could like sure. Charlotte and Rose to.
And I do wonder, because we do get the shot when the military is going out into the field of the younger man who appears to be like a young and Indigenous man who I think we've seen in the trailers. We don't really get to yes. know him in this episode, but I wonder if she and he are connected in some way.
He's like watching whatever the military is doing. Yeah. So it's good to know somebody is keeping an eye on the military around here, because as it is mentioned by a councilman that is convincing the sheriff, this isn't America, this is Derry. And Derry, all of Derry is part It.
Mm-hmm.
So the one things I wanted to add back to the timeline, mostly so we could make sure and reiterate we are in 1962, is 1908 is when the Kitchener Ironworks explosion killed 102 people. That was the awakening of It in the 1908 period.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1935 period is when It awakens after the Bradley Gang shootout, which is now, I believe, in the opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
And I also believe the story we're about to hear about that car they dug up where Dick Halloran told them to dig.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we're about to learn about the Bradley yeah. gang at some point.
It does seem like structurally this season, at least for the next couple episodes, could be a little bit of like Dick Halloran leads them to an artifact. The artifact leads us to a flashback. And that's how we bounce into these different timelines. But we'll see. Maybe that's something that'll be spread out across the entire season a little bit more slowly.
Yeah. Or just all next week, and then we don't do it again. Like
sure.
This series yeah. puzzles me. In
I mean,
where it's going.
They did. Andy Muschietti did say that it's being told in reverse. So I wonder if it's like a slow roll across the season, or if they're gonna get that all out of the way real quick.
One thing I want to talk about before we head into the storm and speculate about more stuff that we're gonna see next week. Two people cleaving in this episode. There's a butcher shop, and yeah. then there's a butcher in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I can see the grocery store just being like It manifesting, but we do spend enough time with whatever his name is, blank the cleaver, the butcher,
yeah,
talking to Charlotte. You think we got what if you were to guess how many episodes before someone gets chased with the cleaver?
Oh, definitely gonna happen. I also don't think this is that weird, though, for there to be a butcher shop for like meat, but also there to be a fish counter at the food mart where they're chopping up fish, especially in Maine, which is on the coast.
Yes.
You know,
so. I just think it's funny that we went from 0 to 2 in cleavers in one episode of Welcome to Derry.
Yeah. And the fact
and
that
not where you'd think.
And the fact that the one guy points out that the kids call him what's it, something cleaver.
Yeah.
I think is notable. So yeah, I'm sure that the cleaving of meat is going to be relevant. The butcher shop plays a prominent role in the movies as well, too. So,
well, also like I don't, like, Leave It to Beaver has also just been canceled. So is it a Leave It to Beaver thing and not a Cleaver like the Cleaver thing? Are they calling him something Cleaver because it's a Leave It to Beaver character I haven't paid attention to?
Well, I mean, that was their last name. June Cleaver was Leave It to Beaver's mom.
Yes, correct. So like they call me Blake, like was his name Ward Cleaver and I forgot. Anyway, it doesn't matter because I guarantee you we're coming back to that for some reason.
Sure.
If we get two weird birthing horror scenes, we're definitely going to get one Cleaver horror scene. That's what I feel.
Yeah. Hopefully they don't combine the two ideas. That would be rough.
Yeah. Or at least give me a break of a week to do something else. Anyway, if you don't want to talk about the preview for next episode, or you want to, you know, spend the next 8 days thinking about this episode, feel free to hop off. We will see you Monday the 10th. Otherwise, head with us into the storm.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here.
What are you doing in the sewer?
A storm blew me away. Blew the whole circus away.
Neil, I've got one thing about bad news before we jump. I got one bad news, one question to ask you if I'm crazy, and then we'll jump into talking about episode 3.
Great.
Bad news this week is Ronnie's full name is Veronica Grogan. I did not know that was her full name. That is definitely a child victim of it, of the Georgie cycle.
Interesting.
So I believe she was 9 years old in the book. She disappears, but she is found by a very weird little boy in the book who has a quote-unquote invention he calls the Fabulous Gum Stick. But basically, he puts chewing gum on the end of a pole and sticks it down into sewers to try to, like, pull cool stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thinks he's really weird until one day he pulls up, like, a piece of Veronica Grogan. And that's how they figure out that this little girl has gone missing in the sewer. And then, after it is defeated the first time by the young losers, Crazy Henry Bowers is framed for all the child murders that take place. And they find Veronica Grogan's underwear under his mattress.
Oh.
And we learn about this from Bowers' point of view chapter. And he's like, I don't know how they got there. So it basically framed Henry Bowers with Veronica Grogan's underwear. So if that's her fate, like, I could be for a lot of losers, but this is one of the people that I'm now much more scared for this character than I was before, because canonically she dies.
That is interesting, I guess, because, you know, obviously we've already experienced the story from the books in the movies.
Yeah.
And this still being part of that adaptation, I kind of wonder whether this is them doing some cheeky signaling to book readers that Veronica is in danger, or if it's there to throw you off, if it's there to make you think that Veronica is in danger and it's just sort of a fun red herring name that they pulled for her. So we'll see.
I mean, it's
time will tell.
Maddie was also one of the kid with the pacifier was also one of the named victims. Maddie Campbell, I believe, of that cycle. And he seems dead. So I'm just worried about, I get what you're talking about. It could be a mislead, but I think if it was a mislead, she would have been Veronica Grogan from the start. I think the whole calling her Ronnie is so we don't think too hard about the fact that her name's Veronica Grogan. Because I think she's doomed, but we'll see.
Sure.
When they said her last name, I was like, oh no.
The show has also, you know, not been shy about introducing kids as main characters and then killing them immediately.
And then killing them off. None of these kids could make it. Speaking of kids that they may or may not have killed off, I still have questions about Phil.
Okay.
So we talked about it last week in the storm, and you're like, wasn't he the one that was thrown into the window? And I was like, yes. And this week we see it again, and it was definitely Teddy whose face got thrown in the window.
Okay.
We see Phil running towards the back of the auditorium, and then he's sort of dive-bombed by the baby. But then Lily hides under the seats, and that's where she sees Susie. Mm-hmm. And then the baby pops back up and sort of eats Susie. So I don't think we necessarily see Phil attacked by the baby. And then when Lily's in the grocery store and she sees the other kids on the cereal boxes, they all start turning kind of dead versions of themselves, except Phil.
Mm.
Am I going crazy, Neil, or is there a possibility that Phil's still alive somewhere?
I mean, that feels like it would be too much coincidence, Dave, for all of that to be true. So I think it's possible that Phil's still alive. I mean, I don't know if he makes it out of the series, but
right.
I think it would be interesting if they found, I mean, how wild would it be if they actually found one of the kids alive?
Well, also, how wild would it be if they found one of the kids alive? How wild would it be if we're supposed to be asking this question so when Pennywise shows up as Phil, we're like, oh, yes, of course.
That's true.
Because that's also a possibility. Once that you're a victim, as we saw with Maddie, you can become an avatar of Pennywise in some sort of way.
Sure.
I'm wondering why we're not, like, very specifically they say several times that the bodies are missing. There are no bodies to these series of murders. So we're being very specific about this, and we've now seen twice Phil get attacked, but like not something as definitive for either Teddy or Susie about Phil being dead. So I just,
yeah,
while we're in the Citadel of Crazy Town,
this is a tough
Phil
one.
Might still be out there.
I mean, I want to be able to apply the same like TV rules of death here, where it's like until I see the body. But this is also a story where the clown keeps the bodies under the sewer, and sometimes we don't see them again until the very end, right? Like, as is the case in the movies. So I guess we're going to be holding out hope for Phil for a while, potentially. But I'm okay with that.
Phil just got blinked with the deadlights, and maybe you could bring him back if you kiss him.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe he's just floating in the sewer somewhere.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about episode 3. It is called Now You See It. Neil, does Now You See It means we're going to see Pennywise next week?
I mean, maybe not. That could just mean like, because we get shots in this trailer for next week of Dick Halloran and Major Hanlon on a plane together. So maybe it's about, you know, Leroy finally coming around and seeing a little bit more of what Dick sees.
Yeah.
And I think that it's like maybe for the first time, the adults experience the phenomenon of it. And they sort of see what they're dealing with, right? Because they think they're looking for like a weapon that could be like,
right,
you know, just like a physical object. And maybe they go out looking for it and they find out that it's not a physical object. It is a spiritual entity of sorts. And that would complicate their plans to then use it to win the Cold War before any missiles are fired. So I think that feels kind of right. And also, you know, the kids are going to have to push through with their plan to exonerate Ronnie's dad. So they're going to have to try and find some kind of proof that it wasn't him. And it was, in fact, a mutant baby.
So we got that trailer. Some things I noticed in the trailer. Definitely, you're right. We're going to have Lily and Ronnie. They're going to reconnect. So Lily hopefully gets out of Juniper Hill pretty fast. And Lily's plan seems to be that they need a picture of it so that the adults will realize that it's real. And somehow it looks like they go to Rich and Will for help. I'm unsure exactly why they would need Rich and Will's help. Or why those two specifically, because those two weren't necessarily connected to Maddie or Phil or any of those guys that we know as far.
Although Will and Ronnie have now met at the very least.
Yes, that's true. Will and Ronnie have met, and we know Will is about science, so maybe they need some sort of like science to help them out. And Rich, if I had to guess, I would say like bravery. He seems like maybe he's going to be the brave one in like the group, because he seems to not care so much about the bullies when everybody's trying to pick on Will.
Mm-hmm. He seems like the resourceful and like sly one, right? Yes. Like he's not like taking on the bullies, but he's good at avoiding them, you know? So he's the smart one. The street smart one, would be the best way to describe him.
And then Leroy is flying Dick over Derry while Dick is like touching an artifact. And that's when we see some flashbacks. Like you were saying, we're going to figure out some stuff, but it looks like we're only being flashing back to the circus. There seems to be a boy attending the circus. This is a boy in the season on trailer we've seen running from a scary gaunt looking dude. Mm-hmm. And we see a close-up of the gaunt man flash later in this trailer, so I do believe we'll be flashing back to an early appearance of it. But just because it's at the circus, it's interesting we're seeing that gaunt man and not Bob Gray Pennywise the Dancing Clown.
Sure.
So maybe we see Bill Skarsgård next week and not full-on Pennywise, you know?
Interesting. Yeah, because I guess it would be we're flashing back to one of these previous cycles, not necessarily when Pennywise took that form, but maybe.
It could be 1908, 1905.
Sure. I mean, the kid does look like he's 1908. Dressed like he's in Newsies, so that's period accurate.
The only reference to a specific circus I could find in the book is at one point Bill mentions that when he's having his metaphysical essence shoved out of his body and shot across space, he's like shot like a human cannonball, like the old shrine circus that used to come through Derry every May. And I'm like, okay, that is Bill in the 50s, not a 1908 circus. So I don't know specifically what we're going to be seeing.
Unless that circus had been coming through every May for the last like 60 years.
Exactly. Which what a run. But we also see some Dick Halloran looks like in the sewer. I don't know if he actually gets there or not. My guess is it's a vision from the next on, because the season-wide trailer we saw like the military going into the Kneebolt house.
Yeah.
So I think he might be able to pinpoint the Kneebolt house from the sky, but otherwise I think he's going to use his shining to trace the thing back. It looks like he gets all the way to the lair with the floating kids and the Pennywise the Dancing Clown sort of trailer box opens up, and he sees its eyes inside of it. So that would say maybe clown, but that all could be just Dick Halloran having a vision, just Dick Halloran shining and getting the idea that it's a entity down there, not necessarily like a full weapon.
Yeah. Him seeing sort of the true nature of what they're chasing rather than, you know, some sort of gun to be wielded.
Yeah.
Fear gun.
So across the various places on your Wikipedias, on your Googles, on your Rotten Tomatoes, we have a description for episode 3, which is General Shaw pushes ahead with his mission, ordering Leroy and Polly to escort Dick Halloran on an aerial search for a new dig site. So far, so good, Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Rose attends a tribal meeting.
Okay.
Something for Rose to do. We like that. Ronnie, Lily, Will, and Rich attempt to get visual proof by conjuring an Orisha.
Interesting.
These are divine spirits, so like demigods that communicate between the mortal world and the world of the gods, that was adapted from the Yoruba religion of Africa and therefore brought over and Christianized in the Americas in stuff like Haitian voodoo, Santeria, and some Brazilian religions that I am less familiar with. Neo, what of those indigenous cultures exists in Derry for these kids in 1962 to know to shove to summon Orisha?
I mean,
that's got to be rich, right?
Yeah,
Cuban. It's got to be Santeria.
That's the closest I can figure so far, because like Rose attending her tribal meeting feels unrelated to this, right?
Right.
It feels like it's more related to the young man who was watching the military, and like this sort of parallel track between maybe the indigenous people of that live around Derry kind of keeping an eye on the military and them getting at these artifacts because they seem to know about the artifacts, maybe.
Yeah.
What these kids are doing is a whole different doing some conjuring is pretty wild. And I don't know. Sounds fun. I think this show is just like really sort of cranking up the weirdness here very early in the season. If the kids are going to be conjuring spirits in episode 3.
But these are like spirits in some definitions and in some religions that can like lead. They're like a positive influence on people.
Sure.
Like you want these spirits on your side. So it would be interesting if they do this to get in touch with Maritin the turtle somehow, because that is in the book. The book has no Santeria or voodoo in it.
Sure.
But it does have that mystical turtle.
Well, and at a certain
point. So I wonder if this is our way of engaging with it.
Similar to the way the story goes for the kids in the 1980s, at a certain point, they're going to have to get an explainer for what it is and how to deal with it, right? Or how to at least find it. You know, they'll figure out how to deal with it later. But, you know, so far we haven't met any adults, or at least the kids have not met any adults that can help them. So I guess they're going to seek some spiritual guidance
from hopefully a religion that one of them practices.
Sure.
Otherwise, I mean, maybe that's just the grand tradition of the adaptation, is it's always going to nod towards something that it doesn't really want to unpack, but is going to use the tools that it, you know, has at its capability to make that work.
Either way, I hope it leads to a turtle, because Turtle Watch in full effect at this point. We've seen many turtles so far in these first, I guess in the first episode mostly, but I want to meet this turtle, man. What's the point of teasing it if you're not going to eventually show the turtle?
Let's get metaphysical with it. That's also what I was saying to this creative group in between It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2, and they didn't listen to me. So we'll have to see what happens. That being said, I'll reiterate what I said in the call. I was ready for this to be so much worse. I've really enjoyed these first two episodes as their own little weird, funky things. Mm-hmm. I think if this series ends up being, you know, this consistent all the way through, it'll be better than It Chapter 2.
Sure.
It just needs to stay steady. It just needs to keep its hand on the wheel and not, go off its rocker with, General Shaw trying to get a clown in a cage or something weird like that. So we'll have to see how it goes. Mm-hmm. Neil, is there anything you definitely want to see happen next weekend?
I mean, I am really fascinated to see how the Dick Halloran of it all pans out. And again, I think I'm most interested in seeing what happens when adults come into contact with the entity. Because that is, I guess, something that, you know, kind of makes It Chapter 2 interesting, but we're also seeing it happen to people who experienced those same things as kids. This gives us the opportunity to see like fully formed adults who did not encounter the clown as children come into contact with the entity. And I feel like that would amplify the potential of like their fears manifesting potentially as like even gnarlier situations than what the kids are seeing, and potentially be even more scary because they're less prepared for it, right? Because like when you get to It Chapter 2, even though they don't remember it, once they start to remember, they're pretty well prepared for what's coming. Like, right. But like Major Hanlon has no idea what's about to happen to him. So I think that could be really fun. And I'm curious to see how much longer they keep the clown out of it. I think you might be right that we're more likely to see just a Bill Skarsgård next week than an actual Pennywise. I think we're more likely to just keep seeing those eyes in different things.
Yeah. Which I'm down for. You could get metaphysical in a whole bunch of ways. Mm-hmm. I'm into it. Can't wait to see what happens. The downside of a early released episode 2 is we will now have our longest gap of the season in between episodes. So I'm psyched, but I'm also psyched on the edge of my seat. So make sure you guys join us on Monday, November 10th to talk about Welcome to Derry episode 3, Now You See It, which will also be airing on the 9th on your HBO device. Until then, good luck out there. And I don't know. Be very careful giving birth. It seems a little dangerous.
It really does.
In the Derry universe.